You're listening to TIP.
Hotels got crushed. Anything that had, you know, had something to do with the pandemic and being shut down, well, we were the only one that really thrived. I think it was 12% increase in value last year.
On today's show, I talk with Jonathan Tuttle about how his digital marketing agency and real estate businesses came about, why he chose the mobile home park niche, the difference between investing in mobile home parks and mobile homes, what rent-to-own financing is and how to use it to your advantage, and a bunch more. Jonathan is an investor, speaker, and soon-to-be podcast host of the Accredited Investor Podcast. He's also the fund manager at Midwest. Aside from his real estate business, he's also the founding director of the digital marketing agency Revenue Ascend and is an active philanthropist who provides scholarships to underprivileged youth and organizes fundraisers to find forever homes for homeless dogs. I hope you guys enjoyed today's conversation all about mobile home park investing. Let's dive in.
You're listening to Real Estate Investing by the Investors Podcast Network, where your host, Robert Leonard, interviews successful investors from various real estate investing niches to help educate you on your real estate investing journey.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Real Estate 101 podcast. As always, I'm your host, Robert Leonard. And with me today, I have Jonathan Tuttle. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on. Excited to be here.
Give us a quick rundown on your background and how you got to where you are today.
Yeah, just kind of started off in a real estate family. So my dad was a developer for custom homes, built a lot of custom homes, general contracting. He also had three real estate brokerage offices at one time. So just kind of always grew up in the real estate realm and just kind of developed my passion for it, starting off early, and then eventually got into it professionally a little bit later after, you know, when I felt like I wanted to get into it.
What drew you to real estate? I feel like a lot of children of parents who are in any career, not even just real estate, but anything, sometimes they want to go into the same thing their parents do. Sometimes they want nothing to do with whatever their parents are doing. So what caused you to actually kind of get drawn towards real estate?
Yeah, good question. So yeah, that's kind of what happened. I grew up with that. Then I did retail sales in my 20s. Did really well with that. And then later on, I'm like, okay, now I want to get into real estate. I think just the financial freedom and the ability to, you know, create your own destiny and create your own wealth, and it's in your hands, not other people's. And that's what I really think drew me into it.
You have a digital marketing agency, also your real estate business. Which one came first? Were you making so much profit from your digital marketing agency and needed a place to park that money? You got it into real estate, or did it kind of come about differently?
Well, first real estate, because I got into real estate 2010. Digital marketing, I started really getting a passion for about the same time. So it just kind of feeds off each other. So one of the things which we'll get into later, but my fund and then my info course, both of those are marketing online. So my agency basically does all the digital marketing. I got into digital marketing really, really, really into it, like 2012, 13. That was before even Facebook ads were even relevant back then. So, I mean, they just came out. I got really into like the digital marketing side, really deep dive into the agency model. 2017, 18 is when I really, you know, deep dive into it. So, but yeah, it fuels each other's business. So basically the digital marketing is everything's online now, even this, what we're doing is online. So just having that and those resources and that knowledge, it also fuels everything else. And it's, I really like both, because everything, we're in such a digital age, everything's digital. So it just kind of provides for both. And then the real estate side, obviously, that's always going to be there.
In the real estate world, why did you choose the mobile home park niche?
Yeah, it's because in the last downturn, we got our first park, and it was literally when every other real estate like had really everything in 2008-09 was like just down and crashing. Our mobile home parks doubled, tripled in value. So we just, they're the one we had, you know, we kept raising rents and we had people begging to come in. So when I saw that, I was like, all right, there's a supply and demand that needs to be solved. And we have, because there's only about 43,000 change parks officially. So when you have the only affordable housing option, it just made sense that this real estate has something unique, you know, unique attributes to it. And I just tell my friends, they'd be like, mobile home parks, like, what is this? Now it's becoming more mainstream. It's on a lot of podcasts and stuff like that. But at that time, like when you tell people mobile home parks, they just looked at you weird. But I just saw the returns growing. Like I alluded to with my dad, I saw him do all different types of real estate. And this was the one that was the strongest performing during the worst times. And like, that was just the light bulb moment.
The majority of real estate has done very well during this pandemic. And I think this pandemic is a bit different than what we experienced during the recession of 07, 08, 09. But how have mobile home parks performed during what we've now experienced during this pandemic?
Yeah, they were the, according to Green Street, great question. They were the top performing real estate last year. The Green Street data is like the aggregate of all commercial real estate. I mean, some of them got crushed. Obviously, like malls got crushed, hotels got crushed, anything that had, you know, had something to do with the pandemic and being shut down. Well, we were the only one that really thrived. I think it was 12% increase in value last year. And the next closest was like 9 or 10, and it was industrial. So obviously everyone's doing e-commerce stores and online like Shopify stores. So that obviously feels that, but they just did extremely well. And then there was another data, I forgot who put it out, but they were saying like some parks even had appreciation of like 20%. It was like in a Wall Street Journal article. So it just did really well. What happened was there was Wells Fargo that they finance, you know, pretty much every asset class, and they're the biggest financier of mobile home parks. And they were seeing collection rates like 94, 95%, even during the pandemic. So we didn't have issues with like people not paying, like some of the other asset classes that, you know, the rent moratoriums, we didn't really have issues with that because where else can you live for a couple hundred bucks a month? And people realize that. And most of the people that own are mom and pop owners. So they have like a relationship with the tenants. So all that kind of factored into just making it just a really resilient during kind of the chaos that happened last year.
Are you finding that a lot of tenants are compressing the classes of properties that they're renting? So if you're in an A class, you might come down to B. If you're in B class, you might come down to C, C to D, and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of people falling into your mobile home parks that might not have otherwise lived there. And that's potentially why they're doing so well during these times of economic uncertainty, whether it's this pandemic or it was the last one or maybe any before that.
Yeah, we've had tenants before that have people that make 70, 80 grand a year. You wouldn't think of it, but they just live in mobile homes because it's so much cheaper and they have such low overhead and bills. It gives them the ability to like travel. And that's one reason, like, it just, people want to have affordable housing. Even if they make 15 bucks an hour, the average income in America is about 33,000. So that's about the average tenant in a mobile home park. And in regards to investor-wise, investors are becoming into our niche because they're chasing yields. Like, you're seeing cap rates across the country in like multifamily, like fives, you know, like for a BC class. And so we're seeing that like people coming in from other asset class chasing yields because we were like always like 200 or 300 basis points higher than other asset classes. And now some, you know, certain coastal stuff, so we're seeing mobile home parks trading in the threes and fours now too. So it's like, it all kind of, is it more institutional money comes in our space, we're going to see more cap rate compression. But we were always historically known is like, you know, the asset class that was just crazy cash and cash returns and crazy, the best tax benefits because you could depreciate the land at 65 to 70% of it on 15-year improvements when you acquire a park. So like, you know, multifamily has a 27.5. We have 27.5 if you own the homes in the park. But so we have the best tax benefits of all real estate. So even if we don't have like the crazy, you know, a couple years ago, 10 cap was norm. Now it's, you know, lucky to get a 6.5, 7, but you still have all the tax benefits. So we're seeing people come in from other asset class. And then from tenants wise, we're seeing people that just want affordable housing, and or half the tenants are seniors. And so baby boomers, there's a thing called the silver tsunami, which is going to be happening. You can Google this articles, but majority of mom and pops, you know, that's the senior citizens are going to be selling off their homes. It's supposed to be like a huge influx of single family homes. And they're going to, you know, basically flood the market with new homes. And they're going to be going to Class C apartments and mobile home parks, which is only going to fuel the demand even more. And people are living longer now too. So it's only going to fuel the demand for the next foreseeable future.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Hey everyone, it's Patrick, your host of Millennial Investing. Every year, my buddies and I do a guy's trip to escape the cold and dreary Ohio winters. Once we pick our destination, without fail, we all jump on Airbnb and find an incredible place to stay. We just got back from an amazing trip in Palm Springs, California, and our Airbnb home was a huge part of creating memories we'll never forget. I loved it so much, I'm taking my family back to Palm Springs for spring break, and we're staying in an Airbnb home my kids fell in love with and picked out themselves. While I was there, I had the realization that my own home could be an Airbnb. It's an excellent way to earn some extra cash, whether you're saving up for your next vacation, paying off some bills, or investing. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. That's airbnb.com/host.
Buy low, sell high. It's easy to say, hard to do. For example, high interest rates are crushing the real estate market right now. Demand is dropping and prices are falling, even for many of the best assets. It's no wonder the Fundrise flagship fund plans to go on a buying spree, expanding its billion-dollar real estate portfolio over the next few months. You can add the Fundrise flagship fund to your portfolio in just minutes and with as little as $10 by visiting fundrise.com/millennialinvesting. Carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the Fundrise flagship fund before investing. This and other information can be found in the fund's prospectus at fundrise.com/flagship. This is a paid advertisement.
Do you guys ever feel overwhelmed with all that's going on in the markets and feel like you just can't keep up with the day-to-day news headlines? Today's show sponsor, Yahoo Finance, is my go-to solution to keeping up with today's top news and stay informed with what is happening globally. With Yahoo Finance, I'm able to see the biggest trends and biggest movers in the stock market, what is happening with interest rates, major geopolitical events, and much more. If it wasn't for Yahoo Finance, I would have no idea that Tesla is laying off 10% of their staff or why iPhone shipments are down 9% year over year. Yahoo Finance also has a number of other cool features, including a tool that lets you link in all of your investment accounts, analyst ratings and independent research, as well as the ability to create customized charts. Yahoo Finance is one of my favorite tools I use in my investing toolkit, and it's what I use each morning to kick off my day and stay in the loop with what's happening in the markets. Join more than 90 million monthly users today and get comprehensive financial news and analysis at yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
All right, back to the show.
For those listening who may not have heard of investing in mobile home parks or even what a mobile home park is, give us an overview of what they are and what the strategy is.
Yes, it is like kind of getting more commonplace than it was a few years ago. We've gotten a lot of media in the last few years, but it's basically like an apartment building, but you don't own the units, preferably. So you're basically owning land that has like apartment units on it. It's probably the best analogy, but they're actually little mobile homes. And the strategy behind it is, one, you have a lot less overhead comparatively or expenses, like traditional apartment building, you're at 55-60% expenses. When the AC breaks or the roofing, you replace all that. But in a mobile home park, where if you mostly own just the land and don't actually own the homes, the tenant replaces that. So it's less, you don't have to have all those extra bills. Additionally, it's mostly just land improvements. So like your biggest cost to keep the park CapEx wise is going to be like sewer and water lines below it. That's what you want to see. I've seen some people post online like, oh, don't have to due diligence, like drive, buy your park unseen. I've seen people post this on like Instagram. I'm like, this is the only ask the question. You do not want to do that, because literally the biggest nightmare could be like, yeah, the park looks great on Google or Zoom. But if you don't know what your biggest expense is, the water lines, if they're broken or cracked below you and you have a $400,000 replacement bill and you just didn't buy it sight unseen and didn't do the proper due diligence. So the biggest overhead for the industry, what we look for is just the water sewage lines below the park. You get a little water, you get the little rotor guys with the cameras, they go through there and they look at the pipes, the trees, and then that's like, and then just your grounds. And so since you have such a less overhead, it just gives you a lot higher cap rate, and that's what's really been driving force behind it. So what the basic strategy is, you're basically just being a land owner and renting out spaces on it. And so when you have a lot less headaches, a lot less bills, it just makes more sense than most real estate classes.
What is the difference between investing in the mobile homes themselves? I know some people do that versus investing in mobile home parks.
Well, mobile homes is the strategy behind mobile homes is like, it's like arbitrage. I think it's the best way to look at it, because people don't look at it correctly. Like, it's the same thing. My analogy would be like a Shopify store where you buy something and drop ship it, and you mark it up, you market it better. It's the same premise. Like, there's no really the MLS, the brokers don't like to take on the listings, because in most cities and most areas, they're not worth that much. They're not going to sit there and do showings for, $15,000 mobile home, and they could be selling a $300,000 house and making way more money. So brokers really don't put it in there. And if they do list it, they don't know how to price it. So, and there's not like any aggregate data. So nobody's really keeping track of what the home should go for. So it's kind of like an arbitrage way of doing business. And so you're basically finding homes that you could spruce them up, or they just need to be marketed better. Remember, 50% of them are senior citizens. Well, then if you know how to use Facebook and Marketplace and you know how to put some better ads up online, you're going to get a lot more demand. You can charge more. So it's kind of like arbitrage. And there's very little repairs you have to really do typically. I mean, it depends on the age of the home. If it's pre-HUD, which is 1976. But anything after that, they have higher standards. Most of the time, single family flipping, there's so many, you need 700 credit score, so you have to put so much money down. This is a way for anybody to get started, and it's for a couple grand. And so that's what I like about it, is for people, if they understand the arbitrage and also being able to do some minor repairs and how to market online, that's how you make a profit. So it's a lot less capital, to get a small park and spend $1 million plus, but to get a small mobile home, first mobile home, you spend a couple grand. So it's kind of where they're at with financially, or if they don't have investors, the easiest way to get started would be flipping mobile homes.
Are mobile home parks themselves accessible by new investors, or people have to wait until they have a bit more experience and capital and relationships with investors?
Yeah, that's a good question. There is some challenge and nuance behind it because it is different right now because there is a finite amount of inventory and there's a lot of new investors coming in the space. So it is hard to get deal flow. If you're just somebody like literally just starting out and you say, hey, I want my first park, most brokers aren't going to return your call because they have 100 people that you know will close on it instantly and have the financing and they know the due diligence. But you come in like, hey, I want to buy my first park. They're probably not going to show it to you unless it's like something that's way overpriced that everybody's turned down or just like a park that has a lot of hidden problems. So the biggest thing, like I said, going back to the due diligence, you want to do the correct due diligence. Is the most important thing about acquiring a park. So you want to make sure like the zonings, it could still be operating as a park when you transfer over. Because sometimes some cities, municipalities in certain markets don't like it because A, it's the lowest taxation for them and they could usually get more for any other real estate asset class in terms of taxes. B, like the average tenant for the mobile homes are paying 10, 20, 30 bucks a month, if that, in real estate taxes. When they could have a house there, they're collecting $5,000. So the city doesn't want it because they're losing so much revenue and they have the same school fire cost them money. And so for going back to your question, yes. So there's some nuances and things you got to learn. Probably better to like get some information before you get, you know, your first park, get some, you know, some knowledge behind it. Because if you get the wrong asset class, you don't do the proper due diligence, you could have a big problem on your hands.
We've alluded to this already in the conversation, but there's a difference between a mobile home park having park-owned homes and tenant-owned homes. Talk to us about this difference and what your goal is in your parks.
Yeah, well, the ideal model, which most people kind of follow, is basically where you just own the land and the tenant owns the homes. And even for like Fannie Freddie financing, which they're now, because of the Duty to Serve Act, the government has to allocate 37% of affordable housing. And it's usually mobile home parks and land or farmland. So it's like we get like a huge influx of like new financing from the government. And their stipulation is that you have to have a certain, like less than 25 park-owned homes. So they don't even want, and they also want to have a contingency plan to how to get those off your hands, basically. What are you going to do to market it? Obviously, just do Facebook Marketplace, have a website. That's all you really need to do. So you don't want to have all this extra, ideally, you don't want to have all those extra homes because then it's more management, more labor. You can make it part of your business, cycle when you transfer new owners and mark them up like $5,000 or $10,000 every time you flip them and put in some new paint, power wash the outside. So there is an income stream from that, but the value to the most mobile home park owners is kind of like what the opposite of what apartments is. So you're not like sitting here maintaining all that stuff. You're just basically maintaining the land. And so that's the true value between most, where the park doesn't own the homes, and that's what you typically want.
What is rent to own financing, and how can someone use that to eliminate maintenance and repair costs, motivate tenants to take better care of the property, and allow people to get started without a lot of money?
Yeah, it provides a solution to people that need it. So we just recently did one. We were trying to sell for cash, but tenants, they went to buy it and we just did a, basically rent to own. And the lady, everyday American, appreciates having something that, they want to own as well too. So you basically use it as a way to help the people that need it most. And you could have like, say the lot rents $350, and then you add like another $350 towards the payment for like 2 or 3 years, depending on how expensive the home is. And even if they make $15 an hour, it's still 1/4 of their income. So, and just an avenue for people to, they're going to appreciate it because it's something they probably haven't owned before. Two, it's something they could own and keep wherever they, and sell it themselves. So they typically, most people really appreciate it. And three, worst case scenario, if you have any issues with the tenants, like typically do is you just say, hey, like I'll give you $1,000, $1,500 to get out. And then you just put it back in the market and you mark it up, and make that profit again. So you don't really have those issues compared to like, people aren't going to trash it typically. Like an apartment unit and somebody goes out and they smash them all. It's usually like, all right, we'll give you $1,000 if you want to move in with your friend or whatever. And then we just put it back in the market, mark up $5,000-$10,000. And then we put it back in the market again. So it just really solves that. Just that affordable housing. That's really what it does.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Hey everyone, it's Patrick, your host of Millennial Investing. Every year, my buddies and I do a guys trip to escape the cold and dreary Ohio winters. Once we pick our destination, without fail, we all jump on Airbnb and find an incredible place to stay. We just got back from an amazing trip in Palm Springs, California, and our Airbnb home was a huge part of creating memories we'll never forget. I loved it so much, I'm taking my family back to Palm Springs for spring break, and we're staying in an Airbnb home my kids fell in love with and picked out themselves. While I was there, I had the realization that my own home could be an Airbnb. It's an excellent way to earn some extra cash, whether you're saving up for your next vacation, paying off some bills, or investing. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. That's airbnb.com/host.
Today's show is sponsored by public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member of FINRA-SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into a partner bank where they can earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Everything seems to be more expensive these days. I've noticed this at my own businesses that I've run. You'd be wise to find proven ways to cut costs and boost performance at the same time. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/MI. netsuite.com/MI. That's netsuite.com/MI.
All right, back to the show.
How are you choosing the markets you're interested in purchasing in? What specific data points or metrics are you looking for? And then tactically, how are you actually finding cities that meet those criteria?
Sure. Yeah, it's getting harder and harder because a lot of people are coming into the space now. We focus on the Midwest because the cap rates are significantly higher than most especially the coastal cities. We're seeing, like I alluded to before, threes and fours. And even like I've heard Arizona's getting some prices that low too as well. But in the Midwest, we're seeing cap rates still 6 and 7. 7.5, maybe 8, depending on the asset. So we focus on that just because that just the returns make sense and the demand's there. In terms of like trying to find deals, it's a lot of relationship driven industry. So the longer you've been into it, the more people know you, the deals will kind of come to you if you have those relationships. So then you still got to be boots to the ground talking to people. Yeah, that's like we just look for 75 to 250 units, less, mostly tenant owned homes. And just make sure the infrastructure and the due diligence, like doing the due diligence process, is good. So it's a pretty turkey industry once you're been in it for a while. There isn't too much curveballs besides the due diligence component.
As part of your fund for raising money for your mobile home park deals, you've limited your investor pool to not only accredited investors, but specifically accredited investors who are able to invest a minimum of $450,000. First, where did you come up with that amount? And second, why have you chosen this as your strategy for raising capital?
Yeah, you get two different type of clientele. Like with the really big people that write the checks for a couple million or 5-10 million, like the family offices and the foundations, they typically don't want to be in funds or partners with people that put in a lot less. So like the big check writers and the people with institutional money, you could either go for that or you could go for just everyday. The everyday person is still kind of stuck on multifamily and is still a learning curve. The institutional guys get it. So I just kind of, going forward, we're focusing on the bigger amount because we get a more serious person. We get a more sophisticated investor. Typically the guys and that can write a couple million dollar checks. What we've seen is like, they get it. And then the people we get from just coming in from online, a lot of times are like, oh, I've heard about them, but then like, I want to get in space in like 3 or 4 years. So they're not action takers from what we've seen. We have a 5-year run. There's only 5 or 7 years between everything goes from 80% mom and pop to like 10-20% mom and pop, like, you know, basically how self-storage is. So it's just basically getting a better clientele. And the people that, you know, have the 450, the money doesn't matter to them. Like the people that have a lot of money, they don't, it's crazy. They'll be like, oh, you want $500,000? You want $1 million? So, you know, for accredited wise, it's, you get to market it online. I saw what happened with, you know, Grant Cardone got sued by one of his investors, and accredited, it's just, you just deal with somebody that doesn't, the reason why the, you know, the SEC has accredited is for people to, they feel could, you know, if something bad happens, or if they don't, they have more money than a typical person. So the SEC wants people that have more money to, you know, if it goes bad, it's not going to be a big deal. But somebody that's not accredited, and if the, you know, the deal went bad, then it's a lot more of an impact to their lives. So it's just a lot more with the SEC. Basically, they have so many laws, and when you're marketing online, it's, you know, it's a basic gray area, and it's a chance for you to get sued, and it's also a chance for you to have like issues and I just, things I don't want to deal with, basically.
What are the downsides to limiting the people that you're raising capital from? Does it make it more difficult because you're giving yourself a smaller pool of investors to work with?
Yes and no. So, I mean, if you look at, and I talked of other funds, most of their, and now you're seeing that too, like Grant usually does like 250 to 450. A lot of the other funds that I've seen, like once they already have established pool of investors, they usually go to like 400,000 to 500,000. It just comes down to the feedback we got from a lot of these like institutional check writers. So they want, you know, what they really want is a bigger fund size. So our next fund's probably gonna be 50 million. There's a lot of, you know, institutional money that will only write checks if the fund's 50 million above. It's just a requirement. And so it's just a lot less work if you only have to have like, you know, 40 investors or 30 investors instead of like 400.
In the next part of the show, we're going to get into a segment that's called the action plan. Which habit or principle do you follow in your life that has had a big impact on your success that you don't think enough people do, but should?
Yeah, I think one habit, I think what is having the most basic stuff is probably the most effective. Like just really having goals for the day. What are you going to do? Wake up with a purpose. Make sure you're hitting your goals. I always have, like when I wake up too, I always have podcasts or audiobooks. I'm feeling basically getting my day set. You know, start it correctly, do a little bit of workout too, just so I, you know, keep healthy, because I'm usually on a computer for like 14 hours a day. So just all the basic stuff actually makes the most biggest impact, because if you come down to like the basic principles, it all comes down to that. And for me, as those few key things always make the, you know, biggest difference. Because if I didn't have a, you know, plan, if I just kind of, you know, woke up whenever, I didn't have, you know, I didn't feel my brain with what I needed to get my, you know, basically motivated for the day, it's just a lot harder. So I try to keep it simple things, basically.
What has been the most influential book in your life?
That's a tough question. I recommend Scribe. It's an app. It's like $8 a month. They'll throttle you after, because I do a lot of audio, like I said, audiobooks, and I would usually get like $6 or $8 a month. So, but it's $8. It's like literally I'm paying $1 for a book. So when I'm working on the treadmill, I have it, you know, in the background. But that's such a tough question. I have like a 20 or 30 of like my favorites. I would say for the real estate office or audience, probably the Sam Zell, Am I Being Too Subtle? Because he gives like a lot of his like mentality and his, and what he was thinking when he was buying this property or selling this property. And it's an incredible story. I don't know if people are familiar. Sam Zell is the second richest person in Illinois. He's also the biggest owner of mobile home parks, also the biggest owner of apartment buildings, and also the biggest owner of office buildings. So, but the one thing that kind of key takeaway too, you want to follow smart people. He's sold off half his apartment buildings in the last couple of years and half his office. And he's still the biggest owner, but last I knew, but he's kept all of his mobile home parks and he's adding more. So it kind of shows you, you're following billionaires and what they're doing. They're always kind of staying ahead of the trends. So, but that book really kind of outlines how his philosophy is and what he looks for when he's trying to, you know, take down a deal, basically.
When this episode is over, before the listener quickly jumps to the next podcast or audiobook that they have queued up, what is one action they should take that can help improve their life, career, or business?
I would say probably, like, it kind of goes back to the goal setting. I think if you don't have, and if you really, I mean, goal setting with a purpose, I think people, a lot of people don't take action. You're like, you know, I hire different people in different companies, and like, even if they're good at their job, sometimes people get lazy or they just don't take action. I think just taking action, even if you fail, you know, learn something, but just keep taking action. Don't be afraid to fail. Don't be afraid to test. That's being an entrepreneur. That's one of the main things you want to do, is you want to just go out there and test, because it might work for someone else, might not work for you, but you're going to learn some things. You're going to pivot and re-strategize, and you're going to grow from that. So just be relentless and take action. As simple as that sounds, most people don't. So if you do that, you're one step ahead of them.
Before we give a handoff to where people can find you, I like to wrap up the show by turning the tables and letting the guest ask me a question. So what question do you have for me?
Sure, because I'm about to start my own podcast. So like, what are a few steps you recommend when you're first starting out the podcast?
I think the hardest thing is being consistent. So I think that's the first thing I would mention is just be consistent and make sure that you're committing to it for a year, 2 years, if not more. There's so many podcasts out there that only have, that don't make it past 3, 4, 5 episodes, let alone 10 or 12. So I really, for anybody that's getting started, understand you can't just do a couple episodes and it take off. You really are going to have to commit to this. And whatever your frequency is, it could be daily, it could be weekly, it could be bi-weekly, whatever that is, just commit to that for the long term and make sure that you're really going to do it for at least a year or two before you really even start to evaluate. And then you can go from there and decide, okay, is this something I want to continue to do? But it takes a while.
Yeah, it's kind of like YouTube where I see people start a YouTube channel. They think it's going to take off right away. It's got to put out content until it starts picking up, moving traction, get some eyeballs on it. It's the same premise, same principle.
Yeah, any content creation is like that, whether it's YouTube, podcast, social media, it doesn't matter what it is. You have to do it consistently for a long time before you're going to gain any traction. Jonathan, for anybody that's interested in learning more about mobile home parks, anything else that you have going on, where's the best place to connect with you?
The Mobile Home Wealth Academy. And then the fund is called Midwest Park Capital.
I'll be sure to put a link to those different resources and other ways people can connect with you in the show notes for anybody that's interested in checking it out. Jonathan, thanks so much for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Thank you for listening to TIP. Make sure to subscribe to We Study Billionaires by the Investors Podcast Network. Every Wednesday, we teach you about Bitcoin, and every Saturday, we study billionaires and the financial markets. To access our show notes, transcripts, or courses, go to theinvestorspodcast.com. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any decision, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by the Investors Podcast Network. Written permission must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.